It is October 2018, and this is CUcast. My name is Micah Perkins. Since this is the first ever CUcast, I want to spend just a minute to tell you a little bit about myself and about our organization. I am a licensed professional counselor and licensed alcohol and drug counselor in Edmond, Oklahoma. I've been in mental health for over 20 years. I first started working in partial hospitalization with children and teens, and then therapeutic foster care, psychiatric hospital, community mental health. And then in 2010, I started my own private practice. And in 2014, started Edmond Counseling and Professional Development. We are a small group practice serving children, teens, and adults. We have the best counselors in the state. Of course, I might be a little bit biased about that. If you'd like to learn more about us, just go to edmondcounseling.com. In addition to doing mental health services, we also provide continuing education workshops. We've been doing that since 2014. We've grown year after year. And this past year, we did 18 workshops for mental health professionals. If you'd like to learn more about our workshops, go to counselinginstitute.org and make sure that you enter in your email address so that you can be informed of our upcoming workshops. We love doing our workshops because it's a great way to learn new things and also a way to be able to connect with other mental health professionals in our community. And that is why CUcast was born. We wanted to make a podcast which was educational, informative, and which helped to connect our mental health community here in Oklahoma. Of course, if you're a mental health professional from another state and you're not from Oklahoma, we still believe that this will be useful for you. You'll be able to learn valuable content, and you still may be able to earn CEUs for listening to the show. Just go to CEUcast.com for details. Although some of our CEUs are for free, we do charge a small fee for our continuing education. That helps us to cover production costs and other fees associated with putting on the show. We believe that the fees are very comparable to some of the other guys that you may go to for online training. Here at Edmond Counseling, we are always looking for what we call the three-way win, which in this case, we hope that our listeners will win by hearing quality content, feel more connected to their Oklahoma colleagues, and have a convenient way to earn CEUs. We want our presenters to win by being able to showcase their expertise, highlight their organizations, practices, and other products. And we at Edmond Counseling and Professional Development hope to win by being the organization you think of whenever you need your continuing education. And we hope to be able to earn enough revenue to be able to keep our dream going and growing. Thank you for listening and helping us to achieve our dream. We hope you enjoy the show. We hope it's helpful and informative, is a convenient way to meet your CEU requirements, and makes you feel a little bit more connected to your mental health community. This is CEUcast, a project of Edmond Counseling and Professional Development. Here we go.
Welcome to CEUcast, the convenient way for mental health professionals to improve their practice and earn continuing education online. Here's your host, Micah Perkins.
Welcome to the October 2018 CEUcast podcast. This is CEUcast number one.
Please listen carefully.
Each one of our episodes is divided into different parts. The first part is our provider spotlight, where we will interview one of the mental health professionals in our community. The second part is our feature presenter, which is the part that will be tested on the quiz at CUcast.com if you'd like to earn continuing education for this show. If you'd like to go ahead and skip ahead to the feature presenter, go to minute mark 10 on this podcast.
And now, back to the music.
Coming up, October 4th and 5th is the ODAPCA Fall Conference. It's going to be at the Marriott Convention Center there in Norman, Oklahoma, also known as the U.S. Postal Service Training Center. It looks like they're going to have some really good keynote speakers there this year. This is going to be the first fall ODAPCA conference in 4 years that I have missed. And I really don't have any excuse for it. You know how it goes. You get the notification in the email. You don't act on it right then because you're too busy. And before you know it, your schedule is all filled up. Now I'm going to have to call a whole bunch of clients and cancel them in order to be able to go to the conference. So I'll probably end up hitting the spring ODAPCA conference whenever it comes out. Which reminds me to do a little bit of a shameless plug for our workshops that we do coming up in 2019. We do our workshops between March and June. And the majority of our workshops are on Saturdays. So for those professionals that have a hard time getting away from work, you know, you don't want to ask your colleagues to cover for you because they're already full with more cases than they can handle. Or you don't want to take a weekday off and then come back and have more work to do that next week. For a lot of people, it's easier just to come up on a Saturday morning or afternoon and just do a few CUs at a workshop, knock them out, and that way it doesn't disrupt your schedule too much. We are currently putting together our workshop schedule for 2019. We're really excited about who we have lined up, but it's not officially out yet. So make sure you go to counselinginstitute.org, put in your email to be put on our workshop notification list. And as soon as our schedule is finalized, we will email that to you. That will come out in January 2019, but do it now. Don't forget, go to counselinginstitute.org, enter in your email address. On today's show, we have in our provider spotlight, Maria Rubino-Watkins, as she discusses her ADHD parenting group. And then as our feature presenter, we have our own Kayla Jones, LPC. She's one of the counselors here at Edmond Counseling and Professional Development, as she discusses emotional regulation with children and teens. This podcast is approved for 1 hour of continuing education by the Oklahoma Board of Behavioral Health, Oklahoma Board of Social Work, and the Oklahoma Board of Alcohol and Drug Counselors for a non-specific CEU. If you're not an Oklahoma mental health provider, you may still get CEUs for this podcast. Just go to CEUcast.com for details.
Provider Spotlight.
I had the privilege of interviewing Maria Watkins as she discusses her ADHD parenting group. I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome, Dr. Watkins.
Thank you, Micah.
Yes, tell us a little bit about your practice and the population that you serve.
I work in a private practice in Edmond, Oklahoma, and I work with children and families. Primarily, I was trained working in neuropsychology and pediatric rehabilitation. A lot of my patients are referred because they have some challenges with attention deficit or learning disabilities or autism or other developmental delay. But over the years, I've also gotten a lot more referrals for children who are suffering from anxiety and depression.
Wow, that's fantastic. And you also do an ADHD parenting group. Is that correct?
I do. I run ADHD parenting groups, and those typically run about 8 weeks long. We try to hold them in the evenings so that parents who are working can come. Typically, they're organized around a very behavioral model so that parents have very clear strategies on how to help their child function the best they can in the home and school settings.
If a therapist wanted to have parents contact you on how they could get involved with that group, what is the best way for them to find out more about your group?
Yeah, they can find out more about that group as well as the other parenting classes that I offer if they go to CourseWorksOK.com.
CourseWorksOK.com. So that's CourseWorksOK.com.
That's right.
Great. And so what would be one tip that you would give a clinician who is working with parents who have a child who struggles with ADHD?
You know, a lot of parents, when their child got the diagnosis of ADHD, they didn't get the information about what ADHD is, why their child might struggle with things that other children in the same family even don't struggle with. So I often encourage families either to come to a parenting class about ADHD or to research ADHD, get some good books from the American Academy of Pediatrics on ADHD. They need to educate themselves about the neurobiology because that helps them have a little bit of compassion and give their child grace when they really think it might be willful disobedience or some other reason why their child is having the struggles that they're having.
Do you have some go-to books that you often recommend to parents?
Yes. Excellent books by the American Academy of Pediatrics, just called ADHD. Any book by Russell Barkley, PhD, he is one of the first clinicians who was able to research and then write very parent-friendly books on ADHD, as well as some other individuals like Jane Healy, MD, who talk about learning differences and how things like ADHD or dyslexia or other issues sometimes travel together. The same child might have more than one condition. And so understanding your child's brain and how they process information is really essential to parenting them well.
Thank you so much for that tip. We really appreciate it. And if you'd like to learn more about the ADHD group that Dr. Watkins has, just go to CourseWorksOK.com. Thank you, Dr. Watkins.
Thanks, Micah.
If you are an Oklahoma mental health provider or provide social services, consider being on our provider spotlight. Just go to CEUcast.com and click on the link. You are now entering the CE zone. Everything from this point forward will be part of the quiz if you choose to get continuing education for this episode. Today we have with us Kayla Jones. Kayla, you are our first ever guest on our CEU podcast.
Thanks, Micah, for having me.
So, Kayla, will you tell us a little bit about you and your background and your training?
Yeah, of course. Well, I have a master's in marriage and family counseling from Southern Nazarene University, and I'm currently licensed here in the state of Oklahoma as a licensed professional counselor. I actually have some specialized training in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and trust-based relational intervention. And I use these approaches a lot to give some of the information that I have for you today.
Oh, well, that is fantastic. And I know you're going to talk with us today about emotional regulation with children and teens. So can you define that a little bit for us and tell us what emotional regulation is?
Awesome. Yes, of course. Okay, so first off, self-regulation is defined as being able to regulate yourself without interventions of the outside world. It is also the ability to express our thoughts and our feelings and our behaviors in a socially appropriate way. So emotional regulation is kind of learning to calm down when we're experiencing extreme anger or excitement and persist at difficult tasks are different examples of ways that we can self-regulate. So the idea of emotional regulation is the ability to manage our emotional responses. And so when it comes to regulation, we also want to talk about dysregulation, which is the opposite. And so the term emotional dysregulation was actually coined by Marcia Linehan, who developed dialectical behavioral therapy. And she defines emotional dysregulation as the pervasive dysfunction of emotional regulation system. And so it's kind of the opposite. Like, we're not able to really calm our system down when we're feeling extreme emotions.
So Marcia Linehan, she was the one that came up with dialectical behavior therapy used in the treatment with people suffering from borderline personality disorder. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so a lot of her concepts then are being able to be used with other types of conditions that people suffer from?
Yes, lots of different types of mood disorders, including people that struggle with extreme anxiety and depression, and even those who suffer from traumatic experiences.
So these types of techniques that you're talking about today are helpful for people not just suffering from borderline personality disorder, but all types of different emotional regulation problems.
Yes. And I think everybody, disorder or not, has the ability to learn how to emotionally regulate and even has struggles to emotionally regulate at times. So I'd like to kind of describe a little bit about what emotional dysregulation looks like. So for children, you might see them acting overly silly, especially in moments when they're needing to be serious. You're seeing them struggle in moments where they're needing to transition from one activity to the next. Maybe they struggle with taking turns or often being impulsive, maybe touching, not being able to keep their hands to themselves. Other behaviors that we see with emotional dysregulation include tantrums, running away, maybe withdrawing from situations, shutting down, or what we call dissociating. You will also see yelling and screaming. Now, with teens and older children, you might even see self-harming behaviors, including like cutting or burning or taking excessive risks, along with having suicidal thoughts and ideations. In essence, emotional dysregulation is an emotional reaction that would be considered extreme or intense for the context of that situation and possibly not quite age appropriate. But go ahead. But
this is a lot of a type of stuff then that probably school counselors see and children working in counselors working with them there, or maybe even in inpatient settings with some of the staff and therapists that work with children and teens in that setting.
Definitely. But we also see dysregulation, emotional dysregulation with adults. So oftentimes if you see adults becoming really aggressive or baiting, or often testing others, and are trying to often cause conflict with one another as well. And so it's not just things that we see with children and teens.
When you say testing others, what do you really mean when you say testing?
I think just constantly trying to push other people's buttons, or just pushing other people to the brink of trying to get them to become emotionally dysregulated.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So trying to maybe purposely or inadvertently get them stirred up as well.
Yes, yes. Okay.
So tell me a little bit more about what then is helpful as far as a clinician. What types of things can he or she do to try to help teach children, teens, and adults how to better be able to emotionally regulate themselves?
Well, there's a lot of different skills that we can use in session or teach parents or caregivers at home to use with their children and teens to build emotional regulation. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about how we build emotional regulation kind of from the ground up. So which would you like to start with?
Let's talk about the second one first. How does one build emotional regulation?
Yeah. So as an adult, you probably expect yourself or others to be able to regulate themselves. And at times we do it subconsciously. Sometimes we like bite our nails, take a break, we'll walk away, maybe even give ourselves a pep talk to emotionally regulate ourselves in whatever situation that we're in. Self-regulation crucially depends on our perception, though, of our safety and our connection with our environment. So for instance, if we're feeling threatened, then we're unable to regulate in that moment typically. And so this is something that's important to realize, that when a child is feeling threatened, then their ability to self-regulate may not be what we expect at that moment.
I see. So it's really important for them to be in an environment where they feel safe then, if we expect them to be able to emotionally regulate themselves.
Yes. And I go into a little bit more detail. I have some more information about that a little bit later, and specifically how to build kind of that safe environment for them. So Dr. Karen Purvis, who is one of the founders of Trust-Based Relational Intervention from Texas Christian University, talks about how there's three different types of regulation: external regulation, co-regulation, and self-regulation. So as infants, we rely on the world mostly to regulate our bodies. So when we're hungry, we cry, and hopefully someone comes and meets our need. We cry, and then someone comes and meets our needs. And so there's a cycle here, and we're constantly being externally regulated in our environment to meet our needs and to help us get back to a calm and resting state. At times, infants also do show the abilities to self-soothe, which is considered a self-regulation technique. But typically, we see an externally regulated system.
So what are some of the ways that infants self-soothe?
Oh, definitely. So if you see them like gnawing or chewing on their hands or sucking their thumb, another way of like co-regulation would be the use of a pacifier or a bottle. That sucking motion is definitely a self-soothing technique that children use. Sometimes they might rub their eyes or scratch their surface with the nails. That's something that they do to kind of understand their environment around them, but also provides a self-soothing technique.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And so as we get older, as children age, we start to learn and understand our world around us. And so with the use of language, we begin to regulate ourselves on our own. And so then parents, caregivers, and children kind of do this dance between co-regulation and self-regulation. And so co-regulation is the idea of, if a child is thirsty, then we provide them with a cup of juice. So we're helping them regulate in that moment. If a child is crying or screaming, maybe we'll pick them up and comfort them, which is another example of co-regulation. And then as the child ages, then they have more opportunities for self-regulation when they're realizing, I'm really angry, and so I need to calm down. So maybe they'll step out and calm down or find something else, like run it off.
So they're able to start kind of internalizing that voice a little bit to help them self-regulate.
Yes. And that's what's really important about that co-regulation transition, is you're helping your child learn to do this on their own. They just need kind of that extra coaching and extra help.
Is there a particular age that you see where this internal dialogue begins to kick in and children are able to self-regulate better?
That's a great question. But it's very hard to answer because every child is very different. For instance, we expect children at times to do this on their own, and sometimes they're not quite ready. That brings up a good point about like our developmental age versus our chronological age. So a child may be 10, they were born 10 years ago, their age is 10, but their developmental age may be much younger due to medical needs, health problems, or even trauma experiences in their past. So we have to keep an eye out for this and understand like what is their ability right now in this moment. I'd like to give you a clear answer for that, but it's a case by case basis. And so there's actually this study by Becker and Weidman that talks about children who experience traumas can consider developmentally half their chronological age. And these behaviors can include emotional regulation behaviors.
Oh, so when you say half their chronological age, so if we have a 14-year-old teenager, then if they've gone through a lot of trauma, then basically expecting them to behave emotionally like a 7 or 8-year-old.
Yes, yes. But with the coaching and the ability and the flexibility of their caregiver or caseworker or even clinician to stay in that co-regulation state for a while, you can get them and build them back up to their more age-appropriate level.
Ah, so there's a hopeful side to this as well.
Definitely, definitely. And anybody has the ability to build their skills and their process through that extra coaching. So, I believe it's best practice not to assume the children we come in contact with to have the ability to emotionally regulate at the level of their chronological age. We have to consider their prenatal and developmental history, along with other traumas that could have changed the composition of their brain, which often inhibit them to develop on track, like with other kids their age. We have to be willing to help co-regulate the child as long as they need that support and until repetition creates the pathways and become hardwired skills.
So what are some of the specific emotional regulation techniques that you found have been helpful for children and teens?
Yes, okay. Well, hopefully by now you kind of can understand the benefit of building these emotional regulation skills. But research does show that there's a strong social and emotional foundation in early childhood that powerfully impacts children's later positive attitudes and behaviors. So again, if we're building this emotional regulation early on, it's going to help them in different aspects of their life later. And again, I want to emphasize that we have to be willing to meet the child where they're at emotionally and developmentally. So with knowing those two things, the first thing I like to make a point is to understand and promote a healthy life balance. So making sure that the child is getting adequate sleep, adequate hydration, and adequate nutrition. So in my office, I often like to offer bottles of water, small snacks, and bubble gum and lollipops or like suckers in my office. So at any moment the child is feeling a little dysregulated, it might be because they're hungry or thirsty. And so I have these things available in my office to anybody that can help kind of regulate their system in that moment.
And then I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. So have you noticed a child who maybe that you don't think is emotionally dysregulated, say, I would like a sucker now because I'm upset?
I actually haven't, because I don't necessarily promote like, oh, I have suckers. If you're feeling upset, let me give you a sucker. I use the sucker specifically to help kind of rev engines up. And so if I feel that a child or observing that a child is like really low energy, then I might say, would you like a sucker? And again, I should point out that I usually get permission. I most always get permission from the caregiver before this is even prompted, that it's okay with them that I give them this type of sugar. I haven't. Not in my days have I had somebody kind of use the system like that.
Oh, okay, so not any times that you felt manipulated by the kid that they just wanted to get a sucker?
No, but I will say that if it is happening, I'm going to give them that yes. They can have a sucker because they use their asking words.
Okay. And so that's one of the things that even if they don't really appear emotionally dysregulated, that they are seeing you as being a caring individual that cares about them. And as long as there's some limits, they can't have 10 suckers, but if they want a sucker, it's okay. You're not going to tell them no on that.
Yeah. And if anything, that helps in aiding and building rapport and trust in that safe environment with that child.
I see.
Yeah. So that's another thing is we want to disarm what we call the fear response. And so, like I said before, how if we're feeling threatened in our environment, it's hard, very, very hard for our body to self-regulate. There's a lot of like chemical components and body reactions that I could go into deep detail with. But really, what we need to know is that if our child is feeling scared for any reason, maybe it's overt, maybe it's really underneath the surface or internalized, we have to kind of understand what their fear responses is, how they're triggered, and create what we call felt safety. So felt safety is a term created by the trust-based relational intervention, and they believe felt safety is built through empowering the child, providing for their basic needs, and building a strong connection. And so if we can do those three things, then we're creating that felt safety. So for instance, that question about the sucker, if they use their words and say, hey, Miss Kayla, can I have a sucker? I'm feeling low or I'm feeling dysregulated. Then I'm going to say, yes, you can. Even if I don't necessarily fully believe that they're dysregulated, the fact that they have the ability to ask for what they need, I'm going to empower them by giving them that yes. And so the next thing I think is another great thing to do to help build emotional regulation is building awareness of their feelings and awareness of their body and behaviors in their environment. And so I want to help this child or this teen build language to label and understand their feelings that they are experiencing. Another thing is building how their understanding of how their emotions and actions are related. So for instance, I use a lot of like, crafts and games and worksheets to do these things and to intertwine these educational pieces together. And so one thing that I often like to use, especially with older children, is the cognitive behavioral triangle, how thoughts, feelings, and actions are related and can be adjusted when one part of the triangle is worked on.
So how would you present that then to a teenager? If I were a teenager and I came into your office, what would you say to me specifically to help me understand that?
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I like to use like really neutral scenarios. And so I kind of identify what a thought is and making sure that they understand what a thought is specifically, and then making sure they understand what a feeling is. And sometimes people get confused of thinking and thoughts and how they're kind of the same at times. Like I'm feeling like I don't like you right now is really an idea of a thought and not quite a true feeling. Oh, you're feeling disgust that you're thinking that you don't really like me right now is how I would reword that or help them understand. So I would use neutral scenarios by talking about like how a kid, One scenario that I love to use is a kid in a cafeteria. He got bumped into and spilled chili all over his brand new sweatshirt. So we talk about what he's thinking, what he's feeling, and then how he behaves. And then I prompt them to talk about, well, what if he thought something else? Like, oh, it was an accident versus it was on purpose. And how the feelings change and how his behaviors then might change. And that helps them really conceptualize how they can kind of work on changing their thoughts or maybe even just thinking about different scenarios to then ultimately kind of affect and change their feelings and thoughts or behaviors.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
That's a good example. So it helps them to see how their thoughts about how they interpret the situation really influences then their feelings and their actions.
Exactly. And then there's this other worksheet that I use almost with everybody, and it's a feelings in the body worksheet. It's an outline. It's really simple to make, or you might be able to find one online, but it's an outline of a body with five boxes that represent different feelings. And so the feelings I typically use are sadness, anger, fear, happiness, and worry. And so they use 5 different colors to color in these boxes. So each feeling has its own color. And then we go through each feeling one by one, and they kind of mark on or color on the body where they feel that emotion. And so if they feel it in their heart, they'll color on the heart, or the color on their arms, or the color on their feet. And then we'll talk, we'll have this dialogue while we're doing this worksheet about like what makes them angry, what makes them sad, what makes them scared, and how their body is reacting. So oftentimes with little kids, I have to kind of help because they want to do it perfectly, but there's really no wrong way to do this. And I have to remind children that often, that there's no wrong way to talk about the feelings in the body and or what kind of marks you want to do. If you want to do like circles, or if you want to like color it all the way through, or whatnot. But it's great because then they can see, I feel scared and happy, both in my brain and in my heart and in my belly. And they can see that they might be feeling different feelings in the same spots too.
I see. And so whenever you ask them to identify a particular situation that they feel sad, do you have kids who aren't able to identify a particular situation?
Yes, that does happen occasionally. And at that time, we'll talk about what sadness feels like, and maybe they can identify it in something that they've seen, like a TV show, or maybe another person in their life has been felt sad before. But that's hard to then relate to their body. And so I give them the opportunity to change the feeling on the worksheet. Well, what feeling do you feel? And what's one we could color on our body here? And so sometimes
what feeling they feel right then in that moment,
or that they have experienced feeling. So maybe instead of feeling sad, maybe they felt upset before, and just changing the wording a little bit. Or I had a kid that didn't really feel worried very often, and I kind of believe that he just didn't have a lot of worries. So, but he was very excited all the time. So we changed that word to excited, and we were able to apply that to the worksheet instead.
That sounds great. So what other some techniques that you have found that are helpful with children?
Yes. So we're talking about like kind of building emotional regulation, right? So those things were kind of helping us build awareness of our feelings and our body and our behaviors. So another great ritual, or something that you can help parents, caregivers, or something that you can do in your office, is ask these next 3 questions. This helps kind of the child really assess and reflect on what's going on. So the first question is, what does your body feel right now? You can have a dialogue with them in the office about what their body is feeling like right now. And then the second one is, what strategies can I use to fill in the blank? And so we fill in the blank of, what strategies can I use to relax? Or what strategies can I use to calm down? And so then creating a dialogue of different skills that they can use to calm down. And I'm going to go over some skills really specifically of what you could fill in with that question there. And then the third question is, how will my body feel after using this strategy? I love this question because it builds awareness of the self and what the outcome could be by using the skills. So it kind of builds also motivation of, well, I guess if I use these skills, I won't feel angry anymore, or I'll feel less angry than before. So those are 3 great questions to help, again, build awareness of how we can emotionally regulate and what the benefit of emotional regulation is. Some of the specific skills I like to use, I have a kind of some detailed information here, but I'd like to point out that we want to make sure that we're modeling these skills. So as a clinician or as a caregiver, or as somebody that's just interacting with children and teens, I want to make sure that we're modeling emotional regulation skills and these strategies. And then oftentimes trying to motivate parents to model these behaviors at home or at school as well. Because the more the child is exposed to it, the more they're going to be willing to use these skills.
So these are things that you may go over with the parent in session as well, that they can learn so that then they can be better at co-regulating their child whenever their child becomes upset.
Yes, the younger the child is, the more you want the parent to be involved. And again, depending on their developmental level as well, you want to keep that in mind as well, because even if you have an older child, but they need a lot of co-regulation, you want to make sure that that parent can be able to co-regulate in the way that is helpful for them, that you're teaching in session. So yes, I often what I love to do is teach the child the skill in session. And then at the end of session, bring the parent in and have the child teach the parent. And so this allows them to show off their new skill, but also helps me understand how well they understand the skill in teaching someone else how to do it.
It's good practice for them to go over it again before they end up leaving the session.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then I can answer or clarify anything for the parent if need be. So some of the specific things. I love bringing in games and playfulness and fun into session. And so emotional regulation games and activities help build learning skills, help support problem solving and planning, help improve memory and attention and motor control. And so those are great to keep in mind when incorporating games into session or with your activities with kids. They get practice in following directions, how to move their body really appropriately in space, and to calm their self down if they're feeling really frustrated.
Getting frustrated because they're not winning.
Right, exactly. I never let kids win.
I think I know some adults that could probably use some of this as well.
Yes, and what's great is if you incorporate parents or other family members in the game time, then they all get practice to emotionally regulate together, but then they also have fun doing it. So some of the games that I like to use, so some physical movement games include red light and green light. Do you remember that game, Micah?
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yes. So using a long space in the office or maybe even outside, they have to practice like stopping and going whenever they're prompted to. Some other games are freeze tag, hide and seek, Simon Says, or musical chairs. So all these games are things that they have to like really control their body, control their emotions, and follow directions as well. Something that's really calming, because those games can be kind of high energy, a calming game is incorporating some yoga movements in session. And you can find those on YouTube really easily. Another physical movement game that I love to use is called Mirror Mirror. And this is twofold because it not only helps build awareness of the movement and body, but it also builds rapport and kind of attachment with whoever you're doing it with. So Mirror Mirror is really simple. You just sit across from each other, and one of you is the mover and one of you is the mirror. And so if one raises the hand, then the mirror person is going to raise their hand. So you're copying the motions exactly. Does this make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So help me understand doing mirror, mirror. What is it about that particular technique that then helps the child to internalize some of the emotional regulation?
So they're having to work on controlling their body, especially if they are the mirror. They have to follow what the other person is doing and kind of give out to any impulses or behaviors that they're wanting to do. So they're having to learn to give up a little bit of control. So like if someone is making a sad face, but they really want to laugh because it looks funny, they have to kind of work on controlling themselves to not laugh and to follow and be the mirror.
Oh, wow. So it really takes a lot of effort, focus, and concentration then to be able to do that for some children.
Definitely. And all these things promote emotional regulation. There's also some board games that are really good, too, to use in session. Jenga, Operation, and Candyland. I love using Uno cards. Uno cards are great because there's four different colors. And a way that I turn it into an emotion game is match a color with a feeling. So red for angry, yellow for happy, green for scared, and blue for sad. And so when you're playing Uno, anytime that you lay down a colored card, you have to either talk about a time you felt that feeling, show me with your face that feeling so I can see it, or talk about a time they saw it on TV or in a movie. And so they have different options of how to express that emotion and kind of build emotion language.
And that can be more of a safe way to express emotions for some children that maybe have gone through trauma and maybe aren't ready just to sit down and talk about everything they've been through.
Exactly. Yes, it's a great beginner option. So those are kind of the games and the activities that you can do in session. But I have some specific what I call coping skills that I like to teach that help really regulate emotions in the moment. So breathing exercises are really, really important because when we're feeling upset or dysregulated, our body starts to go into kind of a fight, flight, or freeze feeling where our adrenaline starts pumping, our breath becomes more shallow and more rapid, and a lot of other bodily functions are happening as well. But if we can control our breathing, then we can control our heart rate, we can control the blood pumping, and we can control our breathing to promote kind of a calmer state in the body. So this one might be a little hard to explain, but I'm going to do my best. So the first one's called square breathing, and it's counting typically to four when you inhale, hold, exhale, and pause. And so I like to kind of draw with my finger a square in the air while I'm talking about it. So I move my finger up during the inhale, counting to four, one, two, three, four, holding, drawing the finger across, and exhaling, pulling the finger down, and then hold and pause, pulling it across. And I'm drawing a square in the air with my finger. And so it's a square breathing because you're counting to four each time. So inhaling for four, holding for four, exhaling for four, and pausing for four before you do the next breath. So that's a great one because it's promoting kind of control and really needing to focus on slowing the inhale and slowing the exhale down, which sometimes kids kind of struggle with doing.
Yeah, I could tell that really rapid, shallow breathing that goes along with stress and anxiety to help them learn to slow down and count. And then they have that image of the four in their mind. So I'm sure that that really helps too with the square breathing to help them visualize that.
So one thing I like about square breathing is that they can visualize kind of the counting to slow their breath, their inhale and exhale down. They can also draw the square themselves. So then they're in control of how fast or how slow they go. But really we want to promote the slow is better. So then there's another breathing skill that I love called bubble breathing. I actually like to incorporate bubbles in my office, but some people don't like to do that. And some parents don't like to have bubbles inside. So you kind of have to get permission for these things. But what's great about blowing bubbles is that you really have to control your inhale. You don't want to suck in the soap or the bubble juice, right?
Oh, that tastes bad. Yeah.
You're right. And so you have to inhale slow and deep. And then when you're blowing a bubble, you have to kind of be precise of where you're blowing and be really mindful. With smaller kids, sometimes they just even have trouble just making a bubble happen. And so I promote just exhale slow into the circle and see how many bubbles you can have. With older children with a little bit more control, I like to see if they can make the biggest bubble possible. And so with this, they really have to blow as slow as they can to make the bubble really, really big. And so then what's great about this is I often prompt them to smash or to pop the bubbles and pretend it's their anger. And so then they can visualize kind of let going some of their anger with each bubble that they pop. And kids really, really enjoy that with the bubbles specifically. But there's a way to do bubble breathing if you don't have bubbles as well. And it's just visualizing blowing a bubble and making it as big as you can. Kids love to use their imagination. So this visualization can be really fun to do in session or at home. Another one that I love is called color breathing. I actually have a great example of color breathing that's on the Edmond Counseling and Professional Development Facebook page or at mindfulnesswithjeff.com. It's about a 10-minute video with a little bit of explanation about breathing, and then it goes into the actual skill of color breathing. So I invite you to check that out.
We'll check that out. We'll also put a link to that in the show notes as well, so people can go directly to that as well.
Wonderful. And then the last breathing exercise that I love to do in session is called belly breathing. And it's just mainly helping the children and the teens learn to extend their belly to take that really deep diaphragmic breath and to release to make their belly small. For younger kids, there's this great video on YouTube. It's a Sesame Street video. So typing in Sesame Street belly breathing. It's a music video with Common and Kobe Calais and Elmo. And it's really fun and really catchy. And so having something novel like that when learning a skill, kids really love to use. And then they oftentimes want to watch the video again and again. And so they're practicing the skill every time that they watch the video, which I think is really great.
Yeah. Everybody loves Sesame Street.
Who doesn't? And so that's kind of it for breathing. But there's this other type of skill called progressive muscle relaxation that I love. And so I oftentimes teach children to do what I call lemon squeezes. And so with progressive muscle relaxation, we're focusing on a specific muscle group, creating tension, and then releasing the tension to relax. And so with lemon squeezes, you specifically picture lemon or some type of citrus fruit. Some kids hate lemon, so they choose oranges or limes or whatever, and that's fine. Whichever one they want to use is fine. Picturing they have a lemon in their hand, they squeeze, and then they release. And what they do is they picture squeezing the juice out of the lemon, and then they relax and let the lemon go. And my rule is, however old you are, is how many times you squeeze the lemon. So if I'm dealing and working with a six-year-old, then I'm going to prompt that six-year-old to squeeze the lemon six times and release six times, and then that completes the skill. We want them to do repetition, one, to create a habit, but to also really get the ability to kind of relax that muscle group.
Well, I love this because, I mean, progressive muscle relaxation has been around for a long time, but I love the visualization of squeezing the lemon, having them visualize that, and then also doing however old that they are, that's their goal to do as well. So that's a great take on that.
Yes, and there's a bunch of different ways you can do progressive muscle relaxation around the body. There's different types of skills, but the lemon squeezes is kind of the easiest one to teach in session. They can do it really secretively if they don't want other people to know that they're needing to use a skill in class or at home or in session even. It's just literally just squeezing their fists and then letting go. It's also a great one to use if you're dealing with somebody, a child that typically gets really angry really easily, because they're making fists anyways when they're angry. And so prompting them to practice lemon squeezes when they're getting angry kind of helps them learn to not react in their anger, but instead use something proactive.
Yeah, because they're already balling up their fists, but you're teaching them to let that go and relax as well. So that's great.
So there's another progressive muscle relaxation skill that I'd actually like to walk you through, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you know who Woody and Buzz are from Toy Story?
Oh, yeah. I've seen Toy Story 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't know how many are there are now, but I love every one of them.
Yeah. So this is a progressive muscle relaxation, and Woody and Buzz are great kind of visualizations to use. So how would you describe Woody as a toy?
As a toy, he's floppy.
He's really floppy, right? He's actually like a cloth toy sewn. Kind of just flops around everywhere. What about Buzz? How would you describe Buzz?
Yeah, he's very, very stiff, plastic.
Yes, stiff, plastic, almost robotic, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to use these visualizations in our progressive muscle relaxation. So I'm going to ask you to just sit in kind of a comfortable position. And when I say Buzz, I'd like you to tighten every muscle in your body as best as you can without hurting yourself. Okay.
Okay.
And then I'm going to prompt and I'm going to say Woody. And when I say Woody, I want you to relax and drop every muscle on every part. So you're going to tighten, squeeze, and then you're going to relax every muscle that you can all at once. So you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Buzz. Tight, tighten. Squeeze. Woody. Okay. We're going to do it one more time.
Okay.
Buzz. Tight, squeeze, and Woody. And melt.
That's nice.
Yes, this is a great one because kids love Toy Story. They can picture Buzz and Woody. They can even pretend to be these characters during this skill. What's so fun is oftentimes they want to relax so hard that they'll like melt off the chair. I just let them. It's so fun to watch. And that tells me that they're really into it. So, and they'll remember it later.
Oh, that is great. I love that.
Yeah. So as we continue kind of working on skills, there's something that I want to kind of bring up. And with children that are often dysregulated, physical touch can be a powerful tool that you can use to help with calming their bodies down. If you are not the caregiver, I highly ask for you to gain permission from their caregiver and from the child to prompt these next couple of skills if you decide to do them in your office, or promote that the parent does this in the office or at home with their child. So what's great is you can use physical touch to promote what that co-regulation piece. And the first one that I love to offer and to talk about are bear hugs. It's great when a child is feeling like really upset or even really excited to offer giving a bear hug. It sends signals down into their deep muscles that promote kind of a calming state. And again, with these specific skills, including bear hugs, you want to make sure that you get that permission from the child and from the caregiver before doing. Another great one that I've learned from the trust-based relational intervention practitioner training was something called the weather report. The weather report is it's a relaxation skill that you use touching the back. And so with the child, you have them sit in front of you with their permission and you touch their back gently and giving them a weather report. So with your fingers or your hands, you'd be like, it's sunny outside. So you gently rub their shoulders. And then you're like, with a little bit of clouds, and then you'd kind of pat and their back with the cups of your hands. And then, oh, it's raining. So then you'd use your fingertips to sprinkle down their back and so forth. Can you kind of picture that in your head?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yes, and it's great. And what's so wonderful is the children love to do it back. So you'd like to take turns. And this is not only a calming regulation skill, but also a very nurturing skill. I'm giving you nurture and you're receiving my nurture, which is great for attachment and bonding.
So how about for children who maybe have gone through sexual abuse or something like that? Is there any special caveats to using these techniques?
I can't express enough that you have to get that permission. And so if you know that there is some sexual abuse in the past, maybe offering, if the back feels too sensitive, maybe doing it on their forearm or their calf, something that's different, giving them permission to choose which body part or to even say, no, I don't want to do that. Oftentimes they're willing to do it to you instead. And so if they're not quite ready to be touched, then giving them the ability to give nurture to someone else is a great skill and a great way for them to regulate as well.
Well, I know in particular settings, like working in an inpatient setting with children, staff members may be hesitant to give a whole lot of touch to children. And I think, unfortunately, maybe staff and therapists, too, might go too far the other way. And instead of giving them a good side hug whenever the child is upset, instead they just try to resist touching them at all. And so it's trying to find that middle ground in there and trying to get the staff and the other therapists and finding out what the appropriate level of touch would be for that client.
And if it feels more comfortable in like a family therapy session or even during a visitation and those types of environments, maybe just walking the parent and the child through the activity together and just staying as a third party. And so just kind of being like the announcer, okay, now it's 72 degrees and sunny outside. And so, if that's kind of your comfort level, but then you're also teaching the family to use this skill together.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yes.
And I've done that in session, with the parents during a family session. So, some other things, again, kind of going along with that deep muscle input is, if you have the opportunity to get a weighted blanket or even a weighted pillow, this gives them the ability to kind of get that comfort and that sensation of that hug without having to utilize touch. So that might be a great option for those children and teens that might be a little bit more sensitive to physical touch.
And you have one of these in your office, because I know whenever I talk to you, I pick it up and hold it all the time.
Yes, it's actually really easy to make. I just got some, like what they called mermaid sequins, and stuffed it with some different weights. And so it's actually a 5-pound pillow.
When you say different weights, are you talking about like weightlifting weights? Is that what you use?
No, I actually used a glass, like vase beads, like beads that you'd put with flowers. I wrapped them up in different Ziploc bags, taped it up to make it kind of a flat surface, wrapped it with some cushion. some stuffing to go into the pillow.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, yeah. And everybody who goes in there and talks to you picks up that pillow.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So another way to promote kind of that deep muscle is by using maybe the cushions on your chair or your couch. So again, at the trauma, the trust-based relational intervention practitioner training that I went to, they called this a sandwich, but you can use any type of metaphor. So I had a kid the other day that I was talking with, and he was really dysregulated, had a lot of hyperactivity, was needing to really run around. So I asked him if he wanted to make a sandwich, and it was so much fun. So I laid down one of the couch cushions and had him lay on top. I put some pillows on top of his back and then put the top cushion on top of all of that. And so he's getting kind of the weight of the pillows, the weight of the cushion, all over his whole body, giving that sensation kind of a weighted blanket. But we made it a peanut butter and jelly sandwich where the cushions were the bread and the pillow was the jelly and he was the peanut butter. And so we made that sandwich and it was really fun and inviting. So.
And he gets that compression feeling that helps him to be able to relax then.
Yes. And you could just see it kind of, he relaxed in the moment. You saw kind of the excitement like melt off. And when he got out of it, he goes, "Can we do that every week?" And I said, "Sure, buddy, we totally can."
Well, I think, you know, working in a psychiatric hospital, unfortunately, there's kids who may be dysregulated and needing that sense of compression, confinement, I guess, for lack of a better word, they end up getting in therapeutic holds just so that they can get that feeling.
Yeah.
And so this is a better way of being able to get that feeling without necessarily having to get into a hold. So I don't know as far as being able to use a cushion in that particular sense, but like a weighted blanket or something like that.
Definitely.
Would be a great idea for kids in that setting.
Exactly. And I think it's really important to, again, meet the kid where they are, meet the child where they are. And so if you can see that, hey, this worked in the past, then offering it before you're seeing them become super dysregulated.
Whenever you start seeing them kind of rev up a little bit, that's the time to intervene.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those were kind of my big skills that I like to use in session. And then I've learned at other trainings that I've seen some really good reactions and responses to. But I kind of wanted to talk and touch base a little bit about teens specifically. So all these skills that I've mentioned can be utilized and modified to work with teens. But something that we don't quite see with younger kids is the building of the self-talk when it comes to their emotions. So I kind of touched base with Dr. Linehan's Dialectical Behavioral Therapy for Suicidal Adolescents. She has a book. In Chapter 7, she talked about some specific kind of self-talk prompts that you can give teens when they're dealing kind of with some emotional dysregulation. So I kind of wanted to talk about those, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to read them directly from the book. So the first one was, your emotions serve an important purpose. They help you react quickly to protect you from threat, to bond you with others, and to add color and excitement to your life. So it's kind of late here. This is labeling the important purpose of emotions, that they're there for a reason. And sometimes as teens and even as adults, we don't quite understand why they're there. Another one is, emotions must be experienced and acknowledged in order to serve the important survival and humanistic functions for which they were designed. So again, she's kind of addressing that emotions here are really important and they have a purpose to keep us safe and alive. And again, we don't really acknowledge emotions having such an impact in our survival.
Well, it's really, I guess, wanting the person to understand that it's okay to have these emotions and that we don't have to just try to deny them and push them to the side, that it's okay to experience these emotions.
Exactly. Yes. Another one that she said was, feelings are always right. It is what you do with them and how you react to them that can be hurtful or harmful. So I think this is really a really good one because it's saying that every feeling is okay to have. Sad, mad, angry, whatever. It's okay to have it, but it's how we react to them that can cause us that distress, that dysregulation. So
that all feelings are okay. And sometimes parents or whoever will inadvertently say, don't be sad, don't be mad, and inadvertently discount that feeling.
Exactly, yes. And so there's one more that I really, really liked from her list, but she had a list of like 12 of these. The one I love is, you are not your emotion. What you feel is only one important aspect of who you are. Your identity is not the same as what you are feeling. Don't you just like that one?
Yeah, that's really powerful, because how many times do people start to identify with that feeling? You know, whenever they suffer a lot from depression, and they start thinking that I am just a depressed person.
I'm just depressed. That's who I am, right?
Right. And there's nothing else to me. It's just that.
Instead of saying, I'm having a moment of feeling depressed, right? Or I'm experiencing the feeling of depression. And sometimes we start to absorb it.
Yes, that's really powerful, that I am not my depression, but I am a person who experiences depression.
Yes.
From time to time, or often even, but that I am not depression itself.
Yes. So she has a list of these in that chapter 7 of the Dialectical Behavioral Therapy for Suicidal Adolescents book by Dr. Linehan, if anybody wants to kind of check those out specifically.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to that one on the show notes as well.
But that's kind of, using self-talk can be a great skill for those who have the ability to engage in self-talk and understand their self-talk. And then those kind of physical skills that we talked about earlier are great ways to really build emotional regulation in children and teens.
Well, that is fantastic. Well, Kayla, thank you so much for sharing those things with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So, Kayla, if someone wants to reach out to you and has questions or make contact with you somehow, what's a good way for them to do that?
Of course. The best way to get a hold of me would be through my email at Kayla, K-A-Y-L-A, at edvincounseling.com.
All right. Fantastic. Well, thanks again for being on the show today.
Of course. Thank you again for having me so much. I feel honored.
We hope you enjoyed the show today. If you'd like to get 1 hour of continuing education credit for listening to this show, go to cucast.com. You'll register there, take a short quiz, and then you'll have access to a downloadable certificate of completion. Also, if you haven't already, check out our free online database of mental health resources in Oklahoma. It's at myresourcelist.com. If your practice or agency is not listed, click on the Add a Resource button and list it. It only takes 1 or 2 minutes to complete the short form and is an invaluable resource to your fellow professionals. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to CEUcast. We hope you found this content valuable for supporting your professional development. The views of our guests are his or hers alone and are not necessarily shared by the owners of CEUcast. If you'd like to earn continuing education credit for this program, go to cucast.com now.